Welcome back to Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, L. Ariel, and we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. We're also on all the streaming platforms, Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, Android, and more. Last week, we had the pleasure of interviewing Sonnet Simmons, an amazingly talented singer-songwriter, performer. She was on ABC's hit reality singing competition series, Rising Star. She's been a very successful indie artist, and she's now currently vice president of Catch the Moon Music, which is all about getting music licensing and music syncing for indie artists in commercials, TV, movies, and more. So very successful. And she also had some amazing advice for indie artists in particular and how to kind of make it as a DIY musician. So really, really good stuff. I hope you got a chance to listen to it. As we continue our foray into the music industry and talking with the movers and shakers, the innovators, the game players in the business today that know how to navigate this ever-changing landscape, we have the pleasure of speaking with Larissa Lamb. Larissa is a 20-year veteran of the music industry, so she is just a wealth of knowledge, experience, advice, and empowerment. And this is a great interview, chock full of information, even just about starting out in the music industry. If you're in high school or college and thinking about getting into the business, she really lays it all out for you. So to share just a taste of her very long music bio, Larissa is an award-winning singer-songwriter of pop dance music. Her latest single, I Feel Alive, won the Hollywood Music and Media Award and the Academia Music Award for Best Song. She's performed at the Staples Center, the Lincoln Center, the Grammy Museum, and more. She's put out several successful solo albums, the latest called Love and Discovery, which is all about empowerment and mental health. But it's not just an album, it's a movement. If you go to loveanddiscovery.com, she has a whole campaign for mental health called hashtag I Feel Alive, with several PSAs about last month's Suicide Prevention Month, mental health resources, tools, initiatives, and more. She also has a radio show called You Talk. It's an advice show on this topic and more for teens, and you can listen at utalkradio.com. In her spare time, she put out a documentary with her husband called Finding Cleveland about early Chinese immigrants in Mississippi during the time of segregation and the Chinese Exclusion Act. So it's a very powerful, moving documentary that's already won a number of prestigious awards, and you can check that out at findingcleveland.com. Let's go back to the music, and we'll play one of her songs, an anthem of empowerment called Wonder Woman. Here it is. It doesn't have to be that hard to uncover who you really are. If I was your Wonder Woman, you could be my Superman, joining forces to be stronger, making news across the land. If I was your Wonder Woman and you were my Superman, we could save this world together, walking hand.
Hi, Larissa.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job podcast. We're really grateful that you could be here today and share your story.
Oh, I'm glad I could be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I usually make my guests do is talk about their childhood, not in a therapist kind of way, but just about...
Oh, good. I don't have to grab the couch and lie down.
But just tell me kind of about... I love to hear just people's early music influences, their, you know, their first exposure to music, you know, what type of household, was there a lot of music going on, that type of thing.
Well, you know, for me, I actually was forced to play the piano at the age of 5 by my mother. I got to be exposed to classical music, at least, and even early on, I was a little bit of a classical music rebel. I like to kind of tell the story of how I used to hate to play practiced piano, and I would actually teach my stuffed animals, you know, I pretend I would be teaching my stuffed animals to practice the piano just to kind of pass the time. And little did I know, I would end up becoming a professional musician down the line. But even at that age of 5, I remember listening to pop radio very early on and being singing along to the radio. I think I was exposed to a lot of music through my parents. My parents listened to more of the oldies back in the day, you know, the hits from the 50s and the 60s. So I listened to a lot of Elvis and the Beatles growing up. and the occasional, Frank Sinatra and, some of those classic singers of the yesteryear. And so I had a very, large spectrum of music that I listened to. And then kind of fast forward a little bit from the age of 5 to about the age of 8, let's chronologically go to my childhood. My father liked to sing. I'm Chinese American, and I was born in the U.S., but my parents were born in China, and they immigrated over to the U.S. and about in the 1960s or so. And my dad really loved American pop culture. I mean, still does. He even when he was living in Hong Kong and China, he was fascinated by Hollywood movie stars. He was briefly an actor in Hong Kong before he came to the U.S. And so I was exposed to just a lot of entertainment. And then my dad, when I was about 8 years old, there was this thing called the Singing Machine. Some of you that are listening may be too young to remember this, but it's basically a karaoke machine, but it was an 8-track. We're not talking MP3 player here. We're going old school 8-track. I mean, this even back then, an 8-track was old, but that was how they, this first very primitive, karaoke machine was an 8-track. And I remember the first song I sang was Unchained Melody. Mm. And so I think, I probably got sick of that song. And then the movie Ghost came out, and then everybody was kind of sick of the song after that movie came out.
Right.
So that was kind of my exposure at a very early age into music. And certainly I think it was heavily influenced by my family, and especially my father. My father would sing a lot of karaoke. Not all of it was good. but then he'd also, he'd like to perform a lot as well, and he would perform at charity events and friends' parties, and there were a lot of karaoke parties. Over the years, they upgraded the karaoke machine out of the 8-track into a full sound system. And then at one point, it was a laser disc. I'm totally giving everybody listening the history of karaoke. What you won't learn about karaoke in music museums.
Right.
And it was the laser disc, another lost format. Lots more. You could put a lot more tracks on a laser disc than you could on a karaoke. And it was bigger than a CD. So, and it had video and it had audio. So still growing up, high school, a lot of karaoke, did a lot of singing, started to sing outside, sang at my church, sang on the worship team there, sang in the choir there. And that's kind of in a nutshell how I got my start in music and exposure.
Were you still doing piano lessons throughout high school?
I stopped piano lessons, I think when I was 13, about the 8th grade. But I continued to play on my own. And at this point, I started singing lessons, actually. So I started playing piano first. And then about junior high, I transitioned out of the piano and focused more on singing. Although, again, I still played. Although I think without the shackles of classical music, I was able to play a lot more contemporary, music. I'm thankful, though, for my classical training. I think it was a good basis, for the piano playing. Even musically, from a vocal standpoint, I was classically trained initially. Then I moved on to more, pop singing. But I guess I've always sung pop, R&B, and everything else. But formally training-wise, I started with the classical music. Oh, and I didn't mention that when I was a Girl Scout, one of my first honor badges was for Girl Scouts was for songwriting. They actually had a badge for that.
Oh, wow.
I kind of started my songwriting career through getting a Girl Scout badge. And then when I was about 13, I wrote my first song. And that's kind of where, I guess I keep going back to this age of 13. That must have been a pivotal time in my life because I was transitioning into songwriting and singing, bashing the piano in classical music. No, just kidding. Piano's fine.
Well, I mean, it is interesting. And we've talked about this. We share similar backgrounds because I too was urged and made by my parents when I was a child to do classical music, classical piano. But you were getting to write your own songs. This was your voice. It wasn't somebody else's. It wasn't one of the masters. This was, your kind of coming into your own, maybe.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is I think what people don't always realize is some of these, I think, musical talents or creative gifts are instilled or God-given very, you know, I believe, like, early on, you know, and revealed. And at the time, you know, things like I would go to sixth grade camp, and even before I wrote, like, quote-unquote, my first song, I would start changing the lyrics to, you know, pre-existing songs. I think I forgot what the skit was, but you know when you're in school, you have to do all these, like, crazy skits, and, mm-hmm. and I remember changing the lyrics to, like, Madonna's La Isla Bonita for a sixth grade camp. I don't remember what the lyrics were. I kind of hope somewhere in my junk in my parents' house there's, like, those lyrics that I changed them to, but I would do that a lot. You know, I remember in high school, we had to do, you know, a video project where we had to represent different writers like, you know, Thoreau and, you know, Milton and all these Shakespeare. And I ended up doing this it was almost like an American Idol like competition like video where I was pretending, you know, the different writers were singing these songs, but they were all like pop songs and I changed all the lyrics. You know, again, I thought it was just something easy to do. It was a class, it was an English assignment. And out of the, you know, all the students in the group, you know, I was the one that felt like, oh, I can do that easily. And because it came so easily changing lyrics to me, you know, I didn't think of it as a gift or even a talent or something I could parlay into a career. But then I realized later on that, like, oh, not everybody can do this. Oh, you know, this is actually something that is somewhat of a marketable skill that not everyone has.
Well, and also you're a performer. Like, this is also a clear example of you being a performer and taking opportunities like a boring school project, you know, and like making it like this is actually going to be kind of like a TV show, but like a big performance. So I think that that's key. And that's why I love to hear about how people got started, you know, very young in music, because again, I think you start to see this thread that goes through like, oh, you know, I was the class clown, or I was the one that, you know, made everybody laugh at the family get togethers. And it's like all of a sudden you see this like thread running through and that starts to shape and evolve. So what did you do after high school? Did you go to college? What did you study? If you did go to college, where, you know, what was your major, that type of thing?
Well, let me back up by saying that growing up, I thought I was going to be a doctor the whole time.
What?
Up until I was about 16. I know I've been telling you all my like little musical secrets, and that's again why it was there all along. I just mm-hmm. didn't know it was something I could do as a career. You know, mainly because I think also growing up Asian American, you know, culturally this career path was not encouraged. I mean, in general, it's not a career path that most parents, most families, regardless of your ethnic background, tend to encourage unless your family is. You know, already like musical, but I certainly was in some sense brainwashed and thinking I'd be a doctor. I got good grades and my dad was a doctor. And so that just kind of the logic followed like, well, you get good grades, like people who get good grades don't become musicians. You know, people who get good grades become doctors or even lawyers, or, you know, they do something that's a really super high paying job professionally that's stable, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I was pretty much on track to becoming a doctor until I was about 16. And I had this epiphany when I was sitting in my dad, helping my dad out at his clinic one day. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can't imagine myself doing this for the rest of my life, especially mm-hmm. since I didn't like the sight of blood and I didn't like the sight of guts or any surgery scene from any TV show like Grey's Anatomy or ER or whatnot. Like I couldn't handle that. I had to turn my head away. And then I would start talking to people and they're like, oh, you have to like, you know, operate on cadavers and stuff like that.
Oh, God.
in medical school. And then I'm going like, oh, let's see, what kind of profession can I do, you know, medically? Maybe I'll be an eye doctor. Like, I don't have to go through like full medical school. You know? So, and I don't think that's a good reason to become a doctor if you're trying to find ways of, to do the least amount of invasion into someone's body.
Right.
As a career choice. And for some crazy reason that after that epiphany, I kind of like was in crisis because I was one of those control freaks and an overachiever. And so I was like, I thought I had my whole life planned out. I was going to be a doctor and I was going to go to college and then med school and do my residency and all that. And then all of a sudden I'm like, okay, I'm not going to be a doctor anymore. What am I going to do? Hey, let's be a music producer. That's so logical, you know?
Right.
But that's where, as I was sharing earlier, like some of those clues that were left behind, I mean, I'd really entrenched myself in learning about the music industry and being fascinated with it. Again, never intending to go into it professionally, but as a hobby, I looked up to music producers like Quincy Jones and, the Neptunes and Babyface, Don was, some of these older producers, or even George Martin, and for the Beatles and guys that, I wasn't even alive when some of these producers were like, doing music, but like I'm a 16-year-old girl.
Right, exactly. Know. Exactly. You should be paying attention to the boy stars, not the producers.
Yeah, exactly. Most girls my age were like looking at Backstreet Boys or, whatever, NSYNC at the time. And like I was like, oh, I love Quincy Jones. In my college dorm, I had like a poster of Quincy Jones. Like, who does that? So from that point forward, I kind of started pursuing that track. And here's what's interesting. I had really no business going into the music industry. I lived in a suburb where, everybody had, kind of a white picket fence suburb, very unexciting, a suburb called Diamond Bar. I'm the daughter of Chinese immigrant who knew nothing about the music industry. My mom just forced me to play piano, and it's all her fault I'm in music. But, I had no knowledge of the business, didn't know anybody in the business. And so I started, I went to my first music business seminar when I was 17. I was the youngest person there.
Wow.
And so I started my education in terms of figuring out what the music industry is. And so that's the biggest advice I can give to somebody out there who might be listening, and especially if you're in high school or even younger and thinking about music, is start learning about the business. The good thing is now you can just go on the internet. There's tons of webinars and videos on YouTube or just articles that you can actually just start learning about. I had to go pay money to go to a hotel in Beverly Hills, which was 45 minutes, an hour from my house, and sit in a room full of other adults and learn about the music business because I knew nothing. Mm-hmm. And that was my first dip into it. And, really it was a great basis to find out, if this was something I wanted to continue to do. But, I've been writing music since I was 13. And so, for me, this, again, made no sense why in the world this, young girl from Diamond Bar, California would decide to go and become a music producer. And back then, there were not a lot of women that were in, that were music producers. You have a few more now, but even now, it's still kind of a boys' club. There's certainly more women that are producers than there were all those years back when I was in high school. So again, all the odds, in a sense, seemed were outrageously against me, or just the fact that it wasn't an area that made a whole lot of sense.
But if you're going to seminars at 17, obviously you're not deterred though. That's what's great. You obviously had a drive in you. You were still going to these conferences. You weren't oh no, I can't do that.
Yeah. Well, and I think, and I think the other thing that I would share is that I think motivation is very important. Mm-hmm. For me, I think I was motivated by something that was somewhat of a challenge. I think if I had been born white and male, I don't know if I'd be in music and entertainment. I think because I was a minority, because there were not a lot of people that looked like me, whether it's being a woman or being somebody Asian, I felt this compulsion to I'm going to prove everybody wrong. I am going to do something that hasn't been done before just because I'm going to prove that it can be done. And in a sense, in a greater sense, I wanted to make an impact and have representation and have that voice, told. And even, listening to some of the content on the radio or lyrics, I was I don't like some of the messages that are being sent. And so that the music that I was going to create was going to be more positive, or it was going to be giving better self-image to women, or what I mean? So I think when you hear music that objectifies women, it that was a motivation to be, I want to be a different type of songwriter. I want to be a different type of artist. And actually, even back then, I didn't necessarily think I was going to be an artist, because again, there were not women that looked like girls that looked like me, right, being Asian American, that were in the mainstream of music. So it was just I'll do it behind the scenes. It doesn't matter how I look. And, you know, as much, and I know, you know, we're doing a podcast here, so I think you might be flashing like a, you know, a photo of me. And honestly, like growing up, I wasn't necessarily super cognizant of the fact that I was Asian, except, you know, when I'm with family and if somebody made fun of me. But, you know, for the most part, I thought I've just, you know, an American girl like everyone else because I was born here. But where those factors started to come in is when, you know, like I said, other people start telling you and feeding you these negative messages like, what are you doing? You know, nobody looks like you. They're never going to accept you. They're never going to, you know, like, why would you even try to do that? You should go to Asia. You should be a pop star there. It's so much easier. A lot of people, you'll make a lot more money. And again, you know, maybe it's stubbornness. Maybe it's, I don't know, you know, bravado on my part, but naivety. I don't know what it was. But for me, I really felt I wanted to stay in the U.S. And I had opportunities to go to Asia. But I, being an American, English being my first language, that's what I write as a creative. I wrote music in lyrics in English. I wanted to be here, and I wanted to prove that I had as much talent as the next person, regardless of gender or ethnicity.
That's really powerful. I'm so really grateful you shared that. Can you talk to us about kind of the nuts and bolts? Like, so how did you do that? Like, what did you, you went to college. Where did you go to school?
I went to UCLA. Go Bruins.
Okay, great. Yeah. So you're at UCLA, and, you know, what's the next steps? What did you do?
Well, I will say this. When I was deciding for colleges, there were a few college choices on the table, and this might be helpful for anyone who's kind of in that phase, or maybe they have children that are in this phase. So I was applying to, you know, four-year universities, UCLA being one of them, and then I was thinking about going to NYU, which had a music and business program, because at this time I wasn't thinking of becoming a performer. I was thinking of becoming a producer, a songwriter, and possibly record executive, and the Berklee College of Music in Boston, which has a music production program. One of the things that tilted why I, you know, staying at UCLA is the fact that I wanted to be, you know, after I graduated college, I wanted to kind of stay in LA and be around that area to work. And so I think if you're deciding on where you want to go to school, you know, especially if you're going into like, you know, entertainment or music, think about where you might want to end up afterwards. I mean, if you don't know, that's okay, but it's helpful to go to a school that, you know, eventually you're going to maybe stay in that area afterwards from an entertainment standpoint. Because of internships, you know, because once I got to college and I started interning, and this leads to, you know, how I got my start, you know, one of my first internships is now, and this really dates me because this company is no longer in existence, is Polygram. Polygram Distribution Group, which is now part of, it got swallowed up by Universal way back. A lot of the companies started eating each other up. That was in Santa Monica, not too far from UCLA. And all my internships, I eventually ended up working for Randy Jackson, who, former American Idol judge, bass player extraordinaire, right, when he was VP of A&R at Columbia Records. I was able to do all those internships in LA. I've had many conversations with friends who were in Boston, who were originally from LA. I know you're from the East Coast. That's your hood a little bit. You know, people that were originally from LA went away to the East Coast to pursue music, and then came back to LA, and they were starting from square one because all their contacts were in the East Coast, and then they wanted to come back to LA to work, and it was much more difficult for them. So that's just kind of a little bit of word of advice for people who are kind of deciding between schools and you know, where to do internships, et cetera, is to go kind of where you think you want to be, because those connections in those areas are kind of last you through, you know, your career. So it's important to know geographically. Again, if you don't know all those answers, it's totally okay. You'll figure it out as you go along. I had to figure it out as I went along. So yeah, got my first internship when I was at UCLA. Now, I was a business economics major. I will say that. Part of the reason is it made my parents happy, because I also did consider going to recording school, you know, trade school here in Hollywood. I decided to get, you know, my education, because at the time I didn't know what was going to happen. So I think it was wise to get a degree that was going to be useful, you know, regardless what happened. And here's what people don't realize about the music business. They emphasize the music and they don't emphasize the business, but it really is a business. And I think more and more nowadays, how everything is, you know, very DIY and people really have to kind of build their own brand and people are basically running. I mean, as a musician, if you're an artist, if you're a songwriter, you basically are your own business. You know, gone are the days of staff writers in a lot of cases. You have a little bit of that. When, you know, you're talking about maybe TV, and, you know, and I can get into that a little bit because I did, write, you know, compose music for TV later on in my career. But, for the most part, you are your own business. And so, I think having that foundation was very important for me. You know, secondly, going into pop music as opposed to classical or, you know, at the time, our school added a jazz department at UCLA. You know, that's great for performance. If you want to teach to be a music major, you know, that's all great. It's a, you know, obviously great, you know, foundation. It's great to build up the skill set if performance is definitely what you want to do or teaching, you know, music. But for me, at the time when I was wanting to be a music producer and maybe wanting to do a little bit of the business side and being an executive, like it, I felt that was going to be more helpful and that I would learn most everything from the internship side, which in a sense proved to be true. And I worked at a recording studio too. So that's another, here's the like Larissa's tips thing. I feel like we should do like a little bell every time I give a little bit. Internships are really important. Somebody at college, my guidance, you know, counselor or advisor, you know, said like, oh, you don't need to do an internship until your junior year. Worst advice that you can ever give somebody going into entertainment. Thankfully, I ignored him, and I was this, again, overachieving, you know, student. So my freshman year, I got that PolyGram internship, and I had an internship, at least one internship. I think at one point I was holding down two different internships. I was at a recording studio and then working for a publisher, and, you know, I think at any given time I was having, you know, most of the time I held, like, two different internships, and they were normally in two different aspects of the industry. So I would say, get an internship early as soon as you can, because the more you learn at an early, you know, time, that just gives you a greater advantage. Two, you will also learn that what you like and what you don't like. So it's okay if you do an internship and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, this is really boring. This is not exactly what, you know, I felt. Or you maybe you don't even have an interest in that area. For instance, I actually thought I wanted to maybe do A&R, you know, which for those listening don't know what that is the people that sign artists and develop artists. And A&R is like kind of taking a different form nowadays, but it's basically, you know, a lot of talent scouting and deciding what music gets signed, you know, to a label. And so I, you know, worked for Randy Jackson when he was in A&R, and I loved working with him. He's a great guy. I learned a lot, mainly a lot from his assistant, because he was doing all the, you know, heavy lifting. But, you know, one of the things I learned is, like, I didn't really like it that much. You know, I was answering calls for Randy and screening a lot of crazy people who all wanted to be famous and were sending in demos. And then just having to, you know, deal with some of the company politics. And it was a very unstable job, too. Like, I think I was interning for almost a year at Columbia Records. Randy was still there when I left. But from the time I started and then the time I left, I think three A&R people, like, came and went. So I lasted longer as a lowly intern than some of these top dog, like, A&R, you know, guys and girls. That showed me, like, and there was a lot of yelling and a lot of pressure, because if you don't produce a hit, you know, artist, then, you can't see me because we're on a podcast, but I am doing that, you know, the hand over the neck hand motion right now.
Right.
Your neck is on the chopping block, you know. So that was one thing I learned. I learned a lot of other valuable skills, you know, like I learned to do expense reports and you know, how distribution was managed and all these other things working on my, you know, several different internships. But I definitely learned I did not like A&R. I did enjoy being in the recording studio. I hung out with a lot of major producers, Grammy-winning, you know, hit record-making, you know, producers. And recording artist. I worked at a recording studio called Schnee Studio, and you know, Bill Schnee himself, a mixing engineer, has worked with major artists like Whitney Houston and Elton John and just so many different artists. And artists that used to come to the studio were there was a lot of jazz artists, some older pop artists as well, but you know, people like Natalie Cole. so sad. I'm like naming artists and a lot of them are gone.
That's unfortunately the way of the world right now.
Yeah, I know. It's like we keep losing all these like music artists, you know, George Benson, Diana Krall, you know, there when Diana Krall was like still kind of an unknown artist, you know. And so I got to see some just very, very, you know, top notch, you know, people work. And, you know, I did enjoy being a producer. I also, you know, I think enjoyed the recording process. I enjoyed just listening to these stories and listening to, just kind of some of the technical aspects of how the art, you know, was done. And at the same time, I also realized like, I didn't want to be a full-time recording engineer too, because, you know, they basically like stay in a recording studio like all day and all night and never leave. And so, so, you know, again, I think those are the important things of learning in that environment.
Those are great. This has been so valuable because I think a lot of people don't have that idea, you know, especially when you're young and, you know, it's sort of like, oh, I can do whatever I want, but it's like, start making decisions more on the early side of, you know, where you want to be, you know, set your sights on that. And I just want to pivot because in the interest of time, I really want to focus on you as an artist. And I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about your evolution as an artist, you know, and how you've really managed to expand your brand, to really use a lot of, I think, very creative marketing and outreach, really take your career to the next level?
Well, I think, I'm going to try to figure out where I'm going to start with this. So to kind of make a long story short, you know, after graduating UCLA, I ended up becoming the CFO of a record label. And from there, I ended up singing with a group called Nitro Praise, which did gospel EDM. And
that's quite a mix.
And that was a really good, you know, experience. So, you know, I think I initially shared I didn't necessarily want to become an artist. Mm. And so that business background helped me get my first job and all those, you know, internships and kind of learning a little bit about everything. And then it was there where, because I wanted to be a producer, so I had to make my own demos. And, you know, again, it goes back to being self-sufficient. And so it's like, well, since I'm a producer, I, you know, make my own demos for my songs. I'm the songwriter. But, you know, thankfully I sang. Some people have to hire a singer or get a singer to, you know, sing on their demos. I sang on all my own demos. And so people would hear my demos that I was pitching for production. And then they'd be like, oh, you sing. And so then that's how I got to end up singing. So after I toured with the group for a couple of years, I left the record label and decided to go solo at the urging of different people. And I think that kind of one of the turning points too was that my parents initially were, you know, freaking out that I was going into music when I told them when I was 16 I didn't want to be a doctor anymore. And, you know, and eventually I think they started to see the talent and I was taking steps to, you know, actually ensure some semblance of normalcy. Like I wasn't waiting tables, I wasn't, you know, living on the street, you know. I think they were I think they were feeling a little bit, you know, better. And you know, again, I was not even pursuing being a singer. So I'm one of the few people that probably fell into being an artist and being a singer. Even though I had the skill set, but again, I never really like pursued it. I think there were things I would have maybe done differently had I known I was going to be a singer. I would have started probably earlier. I think, you know, everything happens for a reason. And that's when I started to have to build, I think, my own identity. And I have to say, it's not a process that comes easily. I think when you make your first album, like everything that you've pent up for, I don't know, 20 some years of your life, like gets thrown into like this first album. And I think from that point on, I started to define myself as being, you know, definitely positive. I think I wanted to write music that, you know, would uplift people, that would inspire and challenge people to think about their life in a different way or to think about relationships in a different way. And the word that only I think within the last couple years that people, you know, like to use with my music as well is that, you know, it's very empowering. And I never necessarily set out like with that word in mind, but I think when other people start putting adjectives and descriptors to like your, you know, who you are, I think that's a good indication of maybe what type of artist you would be or what, you know, naturally your quote unquote brand, you know, is. So as a result, I've done 4 solo albums. My most recent one is called Love and Discovery. You know, each album has had a little bit of a different theme, depending on, of course, where I was in my time period. But certainly now, kind of going back to your original question, I think what would be helpful in terms of defining brand is, For me, it's more about the message. I think the music is important, but I think nowadays you can't just sell your music. There's a lot of music out there. So I think you, in a sense, have to sell your message behind the music. And what I mean by that, and I think maybe what you were alluding to, some of the creative, you know, things, is what you have to be is you have to be authentic first and foremost. That's kind of this generation, like that's kind of the buzzword, is authenticity. You know, it's no longer the days of a record company like packaging somebody to be like the squeaky clean, you know, girl next door, but really they're like smoking, you know, on the side and doing drugs, you know. But they're still trying to push that squeaky clean image, you know. I mean, if that's not you, that's not you, you know. For me, that empowerment and that, you know, having positive female role models. You know, I wrote a song called Wonder Woman. This is before the movie even came out. I mean, she was my favorite superhero. But, it was just this idea that I think we all dream about being superheroes and having superpowers. But all of us do have the capacity to do something extraordinary. And sometimes I think we try to do it, you know, alone. And the song is a little bit about how, you know, when we team up with other people, when we look at other people around us, that, you know, yes, this woman, Wonder Woman, can save the world, but she's even more effective when she has other people around her, you know, a support system and even other fellow superhero friends to, like, help save the world, you know? And it's more fun doing it that way, too, and that we're kind of in this together to save the world. For me, that those messages were kind of important. And, you know, the other theme that you know, I hit upon is besides empowerment, is mental health. So, you know, a lot of my album was written out of the place that I had experienced depression. And I started to write some of my music out of that place of how I got out of my depression and breaking free from being paralyzed by my fears and paralyzed by my past and paralyzed by all those things. So I have a song called Paralyzed. And as a result, you know, whether it's Wonder Woman or Paralyzed, and, you know, the other song that, you know, was the one that won a lot of awards is I Feel Alive off that album, which was about celebrating life, going down the mental health, you know, idea is that I lost a couple friends to suicide and have had people close to me who have attempted suicide, and it became a suicide prevention, you know, anthem and part of a suicide prevention campaign that was been 2 years in a running. These are kind of ways that the music kind of starts to transcend itself, where you start having a platform and you have messaging beyond the music.
Wow. Yeah. Can you talk to me specifically about that? Again, we're running a little bit out of time, but I definitely just want to hear some of the, you know, because you do have such a, I think, a creative and innovative way of outreach and marketing, you know, to really, like I said, kind of get your message across, but also expand your brand to a much wider reach. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I think specifically, so my last album was called Love and Discovery. So what I ended up doing is I ended up starting a blog called loveanddiscovery.com. So that blog is about empowerment and about mental health issues. It's also about shining a spotlight on celebrities who are empowering other people, because I think too often in the news you're always hearing these, you know, negative stories about celebrities or, you know, scandals and all these things. And so I also wanted to point out when you know, celebrities, and not all of them are necessarily like actors. Like sometimes it could be somebody who started an organization and is doing something, you know, worthwhile that becomes an empower. You know, we have like these things called Empower Star of the Weeks that we name. So it's not even necessarily all celebrities. It's somebody doing something newsworthy because we want it to inspire people. And you know, that blog, in a sense, like my music becomes like the soundtrack to that. And certain aspects of the blog, like, you know, if there's, you know, an incident that goes on or, you know, issue where there people need, you know, comfort, like there's a lot of obviously tragic things going on around the world and in our country, you know, very recently and, you know, it seems like to be on an ongoing basis. Maybe I'll blog about something and then share like the clip to my music in within that post. So that's just like one very, you know, very practical way. And then with the suicide prevention campaign, that's actually hosted on that website. And so I produced three PSA videos that used my theme song, I Feel Alive, as the sound, as the background music and as a theme. So that's how that song was being used. Off of that, that gave me a platform to, you know, perform at different mental health related events. There's been several suicide prevention runs that I've sung and performed at. And so that starts to kind of become your audience. Those starts to become, you know, essentially your fans. And there's a niche for almost everything. And certainly in the mental health world, it's a very tight-knit community within the organizations. And I think people who have that lived experience, who have family members who, you know, have that lived experience, or who are survivors of, you know, those who have taken their life by suicide, like, I think there's a common thread in understanding our common dealings with, you know, the mental health, and it becomes in a sense a, you know, a very supportive and a very loyal, you know, fan base. And quickly, I'm going to give a second example, just because I think it might be helpful. Something unexpected that happened 3 years ago is I made a documentary. You know, you're like, wait, I thought you were a musician.
I personally know better. I know that you're not just a musician.
See, going back to everything being do-it-yourself, right? Like, you know, I started to make my own music videos too. I mean, I've had people where I've hired, you know, other people to direct and produce and edit my music videos, but you know, every once in a while, like I would just edit my own music videos. And so, and there's a whole other background on me doing television, and that we don't even have time to get into. But all that to say, I made a documentary 3 years ago about my husband's family. We took a trip. My husband's also Chinese American. His great grandfather and grandfather came from China, ended up in Mississippi, of all places. And this was a fascinating journey. We uncovered all this crazy information and this kind of untold slice of American history about the Chinese, early Chinese immigrants during segregation, you know, and during a Chinese Exclusion Act in Mississippi. We made a documentary. It started winning a lot of awards. And all of a sudden, I put out my album around the same, my album Love and Discovery around the same time. And my film was doing better than my album, which I spent 5 years working on and like probably like, you know, 10 times as much money on. Mm-hmm. Or actually more than 10 times as much money on. And my documentary was kind of taking off. And so what I ended up doing is I ended up packaging the documentary. And our documentary is a short. It's only like 13 minutes.
What's the name of it, Larissa? What's the name of it?
It's called Finding Cleveland.
Finding Cleveland. Okay.
It's called Finding Cleveland. Findingcleveland.com. You can see a trailer of it. But we started packaging it as the Finding Cleveland experience. What it is, it's untold Asian American stories through music and film. So my husband is a hip hop artist, and you know, again, we're both Chinese American, doing, you know, kind of unusual genres of music, and and his lyrical content is actually specifically sometimes out of the, he's not, you know, rapping about typical rap subjects. He raps about thermodynamics, because he's an engineer, and he raps about dim sum, you know, the Chinese cuisine. And we started touring with our music, where we do a little bit of music, we show the film, we have the discussion afterwards about this untold history, about the Asian American experience. And we've basically been touring nonstop for the last 2 years. So
that's fantastic.
All that to say is that sometimes something in your story, I mean, not everybody has that same story, but there's something in your story, whoever's listening out there, that you can start to think beyond just the music of like, oh, I'm going to go play a show at this cafe, or I'm just going to do YouTube videos. Well, you know, whatever you decide to do, like, hopefully there's another meaning, there's another platform behind it, because the reality is there's a ton of people doing music now. You know, anybody can turn on their phone and record something.
Right.
And so how you cut through that clutter, how you kind of build yourself up to have some longevity, is figuring out what that brand is and to go beyond that.
That's brilliant. So I do have to wrap up in the interest of time, but can you give me a really quick pitch of what's coming down the pike for you, the future?
Well, for me is we're continuing the Finding Cleveland Experience tour. You can go to the website, findingcleveland.com, to find out when we're going to be performing showing the film next. I'm working on a second documentary that is expanding that story. As far as music is concerned, I'm continuing to perform. The mental health platform is still there and building that brand of loveanddiscovery.com. You can go to that website. For me, I think I'm starting to think about video content related, again, to putting out the music and telling stories and telling, mental health stories through the music. So you can be on the lookout for that. I don't know where the future is, going to take me. I think musically, I think there's a lot of things that I'd like to do. The jazz album that I've always wanted to record. I've always wanted to write my own musical. I have done music for another person's musical, but I have some ideas to do a musical. Creatively, I think there's a lot of directions I can go, but down the pipeline is more Finding Cleveland touring. Larissa Lamb is an artist making music and music videos that reflect empowering themes and putting a spotlight on mental health. So yeah, that's me.
That's fantastic. Well, I have no doubt it's going to continue to be amazing. And I'm just cracking up because it's like you've already done a lifetime and it's like you're just getting started.
It's weird. I do feel like I'm getting started. I feel like you have to constantly reinvent yourself. And I'm having to revamp. Oh yeah, LarissaLamb.com, my personal website, is going to be rebranded and revamped because right now it's just focused on music. But as I just mentioned, there's so many different things. Like I used to keep them all separate, but I realize it's more about me and it's not just all about the music. So I'm going to be rebranding my website to reflect all the different things that I think I do.
I eagerly await, the next chapter of world domination. So thank you so much.
I hope so. It's world changing.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely. All right, my dear. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me on. And hopefully whatever nonsense I spilled out is helpful to the audience.
I told you it was going to be a good interview, didn't I? So let me give you Larissa's numerous websites with all her different projects. The main one that she talked about revamping with her music and everything else is LarissaLamb.com. So LarissaLamb.com. Her mental health campaign website is LoveAndDiscovery.com. And then the advice show, radio show for teens is UTalkRadio.com. And then last but not least, the documentary website is FindingCleveland.com. So definitely check those all out. She's just a powerhouse. She's also on all the social media platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and all that good stuff. I hope you really enjoyed this interview as much as I did and got a lot of information, whether you're just starting out or rethinking steps or going in a new direction. I think there's something for everyone, as they say. I am Elle Ariel, your host. Again, our website is musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. You can find my musical musings and more at LarielMusic.com. That's LarielMusic.com. And I'm also on social media and YouTube and all that good stuff. So see you next week. Have again a wonderful week. Take good care and remember to keep on hustling, pursue that dream, don't give up.